Hello, I'm Christopher Cassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. It is no exaggeration to say that the history of modern Ireland has been played out on the stage of our national theatre. The Abbey was founded in 1904, and after independence became the first publicly subsidised theatre in the English-speaking world. It was there that Ireland saw many of the great plays of Gregory, Yeats, Synge, O'Casey and others, often to great public debate and controversy. The Abbey has also brought Irish theatre to stages all around the world through its highly successful touring productions, alongside promoting new playwrights here at home. Recent decades, however, have seen financial and management difficulties, alongside a long-delayed building redevelopment plan. Katrina McLaughlin is co-director and artistic director of the Abbey Theatre, where her recent production of Brian Friel's translations won a UK Theatre Award after its tour of Ireland North and South. At Ireland's Edge in Dingle, she talked about her work, the Abbey, and theatre more broadly with musician and cultural consultant Dermot McLaughlin.
Hello and good afternoon, everyone. My name's Dermot McLaughlin. I'm delighted to be here with Katrina McLaughlin. McLaughlins are just great. and the stage is full of them right now. And we're going to have a chat. Of course, a background issue for the conference this year is about trust, and we've been exploring that from very different and diverse angles. And for this conversation, we're delighted that the director of Ireland's National Theatre, the Abbey, is with us, and we're going to explore issues around trust from an artistic perspective. But before we get into that, we might just give a little bit of context, Katrina, about you and where you're from. And let me just say one word, Inishowen.
I know. So, I grew up in Carndonagh, which is right in the centre of the peninsula, and went to secondary school there, went to university in Coleraine, studied science. Had what might be called parental guidance in that regard. people who weren't that interested in the ADME doing theatre. So I studied science and worked in biochemistry briefly before moving into the arts and into theatre.
And could I ask you just, if we focus on Inishowen for a moment as well, if you think of Inishowen, it's about the size of County Leitrim.
Yeah.
It has a broadly similar population, high 30s, maybe 40,000 people. And as far as we know, there is no purpose-built, professionally managed arts infrastructure of any sort for people in Inishowen. Mm. And you're the director of Ireland's National Theatre. Discuss.
Do you know what? I think it's more about, I suppose, artistic thinking, because, you know, the thing about places like this, and this is a similar, mind you, we didn't have festivals like this, but what you do have is space and sky and no infrastructure and no resources. So if you're the type of personality that doesn't particularly like Gaelic or play Gaelic, you kind of go into yourself a little bit. So you read, you write, you draw, you walk in the mountains, and I think that's where all our art forms are kind of born from, isn't it? The space to think and dream. And I think, you know, somewhere like Inishowen has an unbelievably high number of people in the arts. You know, Paul from the same town as I just won the Booker Prize. It's no accident Frank McGuinness, Brian Friel chose those places. It's no accident that people make art in places where there's nowhere to go and nothing to do but inside your own head.
Good. Yeah, I think that's a very good way of raising the question also of your own artistic motivation and your own artistic personality and career. You've a couple of decades of directing behind you. You have things to say, and there are things that you want people to think about and maybe challenge themselves about. Would you say a little bit about that, about your perhaps even start with the leap from the sciences across into the humanities?
Good. I suppose growing up, you know, we had loads of feshes. There was feshes every year. So poetry and the idea of being in front of an audience really appealed to me. I loved it. It's why I wanted to get into theatre, because I was really shy. And the idea of being able to say someone else's words and recite a poem and communicate, I think, was the starting point. And then going to university and being embedded in science and being at that age of, you know, 19, 20, and not having that communication or ability to express, I think, had a big impact on me. So I kind of went into myself a little bit, I would say, and I definitely lost something. I suppose that, like, I went to Derry, I worked in the water executive analysing sewage. So, you know, if you're gonna go dark, go dark. it didn't, let's just say, it didn't lift my soul in the way the poetry did. So I wrote my resignation and I went and volunteered in the playhouse in Derry. And at that time, it was the mid-90s, and I trained as in conflict and resolution facilitation using drama. And I worked in the north and all over in Germany and South Africa using those skills. And the more I did it, the more I wanted to train in professional theatre. So I did a part-time course at the Gaiety. My parents thought, I was doing a master's in science communication at the same time, but let's just say we didn't get to the end of that. and from there, I suppose I started acting, ended up assisting on Rent, a musical in the Olympia, and from there went to London, and that's where I learned to be a director.
And that route, though, I can see that very clearly, actually, when you put it that way, and when I hear you talking about your interest as well in communication, is there something particular about the humanity of the arts and making art that helps you to win people's trust and bring them somewhere that they may not expect to go?
I think it's even more fundamental than that. I think after we have enough water and food to survive, we need the arts to keep us alive. I really believe it. We all discovered that a little bit more during COVID. I'm in theatre because I believe that doing it on your own isn't enough. You know, we crave communication, we crave the shared experience. The more and more we get into sort of a digital world, the more valuable I believe theatre is for the opportunity for us all to sit in a room and communicate either in silence or in conversation about something that is we're sharing in front of us. I think it's fundamental to being a human being. It's how we designed our society in Western culture. Alongside democracy, theatre developed, democracy developed alongside theatre to teach us how do we exist in the world, to show us we shouldn't be killing each other, to elevate the human being, to elevate communication. It graduated from a single actor, for good reason, into ensembles and groups. It was driven by men, but we'll get into that another day. But we fundamentally crave contact, communication, and theatre does that better than anything. Music too, but...
I'm glad you said that. do you see those cravings or those needs that you spoke about there? And if we go back a wee bit, say, to 2008 and the wholly male-generated and largely male-owned financial crisis that continues to screw people up, and the after effects are still here. At that time, I think it's fair to say a lot of trust and belief in lots of organisations evaporated. Mm. Where could people look to for whatever it was they needed, some reassurance or some solace? Lots of people look to the arts and to artists. Why?
I suppose because art communicates as well when things are going well and when they're going terribly. The arts help us understand both things equally well. And, you know, like I always come back to Yeats when I think of this, you know, I'm poor, you know, but I, being poor, have only my dreams. When you have nothing, you still have your imagination, you still have your spirit, you still have your hope. If one of those things is lost, you have something internal to keep you going. Do you know what I mean? And I think that I think the expression of that through the arts is basic human fundamental being, I think. It's a tricky one, you know, being an artistic director at the National Theatre. The responsibility for that is huge. I think the responsibility for that hope that people who want to commit their lives to being theatre artists, the responsibility to writers who have spent maybe 3 years of their lives crafting something, bringing it to us, and then us having to make a decision, is it going to be one of the two or three new plays that we put on this year? The responsibility of those choices really, really point up for me the importance, the fact that we can't not do it, no matter who we are. Do you know what I mean? It really puts it that kind of dynamic for me, the trust in us making the right decision, which fundamentally is based on nothing other than me, my gut at the end of the day, my and my team's gut, and the fact that we're saying to people, not you, not this time, I suppose is and maintaining their ability to go out and write the next play and to come back and do it again. Like, why would anybody do it to themselves? Like, no, I can't answer that, but I've built my life knowing that we need it. You know what I mean? People who write something or perform something and express, it was really interesting when you had a Dumb World here yesterday, and I think it was Brian said, he uses AI now and he's very excited about the opportunity for it, and that, you know, sometimes it writes songs for him because you don't always need to put your heart on the line. And I thought a lot about that last night, because you don't just put your heart on the line, you put your sense of humour on the line, and you sometimes you put your irritation on the line or your anger on the line, but sometimes you just put an idle curiosity out there. And so that for me is why, that is why it's communicating something of yourself in some form that you can to other people. And the difficulty I'm having even articulating it explains why we need it, if you know what I mean. Because there's no definition to why art is so important and why we all turn to it. But the more I'm in this role, the more the responsibility of holding those opportunities and giving those artists the most true response to their work I can. I don't know what I'm saying now. Am I talking round in circles?
No. We're we're all in the right direction here, Katrina. If we move on a wee bit then to the audience, you run the National Theatre. One of the things that you and your team have to do is convince people like me to make a leap of trust and go into this big space and see what happens.
Yeah.
What's it like doing that?
Great fun. It's the greatest privilege I've had so far in my career. But, you know, it's quite hard because we're competing with so much. Like, we're very lucky at the moment. We have a show on at the moment, a Brendan Meehan play, and it's selling very well. People are really curious. It's got women playing parts that were traditionally played by men. And that was the director, Tom Creed's choice to do that. And it's, I think, what's really interesting about something like that, or making that choice to program something like that, is there are certain works, you know, that in the world at the moment, they're very hard to watch or very hard to bring an audience into, because maybe there's something that we would currently find sexist or racist or problematic. And unfortunately, there's elements of this play that could be seen in that way. So you lose a really valuable piece of writing if you cancel it or dismiss it. And I think my responsibility is not to do that. My responsibility is to try and help us understand why he said it when he did, how he did, and what that is giving us. And Tom, in in producing this play with women, has totally changed this kind of very sexist perspective and is unpacking something about the society of the moment. And he has been able to present us this play that's about corporal punishment, or whether or not we should have it, and that it's a state issue. But we're looking at something, it's, you know, the play has a wider impact when you go and see it, in terms of how our society is structured, who makes the decisions, what we all allow happen behind closed doors. It's a really, really topical issue that we have lived through many years of accepting things happening behind closed doors that we didn't see or ignored or chose to ignore. And I think my responsibility to an audience is to not be afraid to be challenging, but also make sure that they are able to receive something in a way that is entertaining and ultimately satisfying and is a good night out. I mean, at the end of the day, most people come initially for a good night out. You don't necessarily choose to go out at Christmas to get a lesson, you know? That's, and I think a lot of people perceive theatre like that. So, yeah, I feel a massive responsibility to get that balance right, you know? And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Like, and I said it already, but all you have is your gut at the end of the day. And sometimes you get it wrong. And sometimes, you know, and in terms of what you're talking about with regard to trust, you know, sometimes you destroy somebody's career because you've said no to them, to their play, and you have ruined their confidence, and they decide to go on a different route. And who knows how many Becketts we've lost, because at the end of the day, we're making a choice. And that to me is the really challenging part of the conversation in relation to trust. How do you, to be the person responsible for holding an artist's vision and holding an audience experience and respecting them both equally.
And could I ask, Katrina, is there an additional burden on all of that, which is already quite onerous? Is there an additional burden because you're the director of a national cultural institution that actually predates the foundation of the state?
Yeah.
Does that add any kind of spice to things?
Well, you're right, it was set up, wasn't it, for us to sort of rehearse what an Irish state might be. And I was talking to someone about this earlier. When I applied for the job, you know, the reason that I wanted to take the job is the vast canon of work in the context of the formation of the state that was being produced around the turn of the century. And what I hope to do in my 5-year tenure is to use the past to help us all think about who we want to be in the future. And that's the thing, that they were trying to articulate a moment in time. They were trying to articulate an appetite for an Irish theatre that had the voices of the people of the West of Ireland that Lady Gregory was living among and never heard, because at the time a lot of the companies and the actors in particular were coming over from England, so they had a kind of an English narrative and an English tone. So how could you rehearse what an Irish state might look like without having Irish voices speak it? And so now we're in a moment where we're changing. Like, a really exciting moment for us is because the kind of first generation of new Irish artists are coming to the fore. And so we have an opportunity now to kind of imagine with their work and their thinking what a new Ireland is going to look like this century. What is our society going to look like? How's it going to change? And frankly, because it is a new generation of artists, the biggest challenge there is we don't have a wide enough dramaturgical history to support them. So that's one thing that I'm a little bit preoccupied at the moment. You know, we have a very Western, even the writing Askeliga has a very Western dramaturgy. We write stories in a certain shape. It's writing, like, it's even actually quite a male dramaturgy. I was talking to somebody was asking me to describe what that meant. It's really hard to explain in a way, but it kind of feels to me like we are used to stories told by men. And there's an emotional relationship to storytelling that men have that slightly distances themselves from it. Now, I'm talking historically, not contemporary. Well, I'm talking both.
Keep talking.
But you know what I mean? Like, if you look at even a classic Irish play like The Plough and the Stars, what they're unpacking is a serious emotional moment in Irish culture. Now, there's emotion in the play, but the whole thing is dealt with humour and with caricature and through a veil of alcohol. And then there's a couple of female characters that kind of comment a little bit on the emotion of it. But that's not how we work totally. That's how half of us work some of the time. So even to get the full picture, you know, like a couple of years ago I read this play called Distinguished Villa by Katie O'Brien, who's an Irish dramatist, ended up moving to London. The play is superb. It's like, Streetcar Named Desire meets The Doll's House, and I couldn't believe I've never seen it. I've seen Plough and the Stars 68, or it's been on the Abbey stage 68 times. Why? And her play is very, it's a bit later, but a similar moment in time and about a certain kind of relationship to love and loss and desire and wanting. But it's not, the people programming the plays, I suppose, maybe didn't want to go that far. Marina Carr is a contemporary example. I'm constantly being told she's too dark to program. I've been pitching her for 15 years. She's too dark. She's not dark. She is dark. but she's wonderfully, gloriously, unapologetically dark. Like her drama, isn't she? Yay, Marina Carr. But we're a little bit afraid of that sort of female fierceness, and we haven't seen enough of it. So how are we going to accommodate multicultural voices? How are we going to accommodate things we don't even recognise? We have to find a way to give a dramaturgical support. And we have to get that. We have to admit to ourselves we don't have it. And we have to get help from outside. So, like a tiny thing we did, there's a beautiful writer, he's Inua Elms. He grew up in Dublin, but he's a really successful playwright in London at the moment. And we brought him over literally just to do a little project for a week, 2 weeks. He did some writer's workshops and then he showed some of his own work. And he doesn't have a traditionally Western narrative. He has a kind of an impulsive, based from his Nigerian roots, it has a different kind of dramaturgy. He does these little kind of pockets of stories, kind of jumps from one thing to the other. And that's so exciting for all of us. Like, that inspires all of us, but we have to acknowledge what we don't have. And I think I don't know. What was the original question? I went totally down a rabbit hole.
Well, the thing we're poking at is, I suppose, is you've got the. I was asking about the additional burden or weight of the venerable cultural institution. Does that,
yeah,
on top of all of the other decisions that you have to make? But you've brought us very nicely to that kind of bigger question. It's almost a strategic question. It's a future question. It's about let's think about the next Ireland and what does theatre tell us about that? And what you're saying is really speaking to that, because there's something in there, I think, about part of your manifesto here is about getting a rebalancing of some things that have been either discarded or overlooked or just kept out of the way, and maybe things that we need to hear more about or see more of. Is that kind of the thinking that you're bringing, say, to what's coming on the stage next year, for example, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's part of it. I suppose, yeah, I think where I was going, which is relating to what you're saying, is that when you're choosing what to put on the national stage, people think that you have to do everything for everybody all the time, and you're really limited what you can do. So the fundamental baseline primary objective of our theatre is to protect and elevate the art form, which has a qualitative element to it. This is somebody else could come in 3 years, I've 2-3 years left, and have a totally different perspective. But my primary concern is that. Which means that if something isn't of a standard that if something will be exposed because it's not at a quality standard, and this is entirely subjective, but if it's not at a standard, then you're exposing it and you're exposing the artist and they don't have the same opportunity to grow. So in selecting work, what's interesting about that is when you look at work that hasn't in the past been selected, you wonder, in the context of that moment, perhaps it was in the same boat. You know what I mean? So you have to acknowledge that. But I have heard for many years that plays by women aren't on the main stage in the Abbey because they're not as good. I don't agree. I don't agree. I think they're not as familiar. I think they are. I think they're extraordinary, actually. And next year, I think what you're referring to is we have a project, which is called the Gregory Project, and it's inspired by Augusta Gregory's producing supportive artists, her passion for artists, not her specific plays, but it's a series of six plays written by five women. It's never happened before that we have a full series of plays by women in that way. Two of them are by Marina Carr. She's 60 next year, and I want to celebrate that fact by marking the quality of her work and having two major new plays by her on the stage. Feels like a really exciting moment. I want to put on Youth's the Season, which is a play that is an exceptional play that I haven't seen. It's Mary Manning. I haven't seen it. It was written in the 50s. Earlier, but it was on last in the 50s. It hasn't been on in Dublin since. I think it was on in London. There's a new adaptation by Hilary Fanning, the novelist, of Children of the Sun, which is a Gorky play, but she has totally reimagined it. There's an Irish play that was on originally. I think Rough Magic commissioned it in the 80s or 90s. About the sugar trade, by Liz Cootey, and who am I forgetting now? Two by Marina Carr, Hilary. Oh, and an incredible piece of work. There's a play that came to us, and it's like a Dickens novel. It's the most complicated, intricate, incredible piece of work by Barbara Bergen. And we're hoping that we can achieve it because it is huge. And it's an incredibly exciting moment for us. But I've said it here now and immediately regretted talking about it in the context of it being women's plays because it's kind of irrelevant. For me, they're just incredibly good plays. They make a really exciting conversation with our audience about who we are today in Ireland, particularly in Dublin One at this moment in time, who we are as a national cultural institution and who we want to hear from. The whole thing does that and happens to be written by women. But I think you diminish what that piece of work will achieve if we foreground that. It's more interesting that we're celebrating artists in we're 120 years next year and we're following in Lady G's footsteps in terms of trying to put the deeper emotions of Ireland on the stage for this moment and this time and looking forward looking back.
That is a fantastic way to bring our conversation to an end, and I love that phrase about who we want to be. I think you've nailed a lot in that last sentence of not just about here and now, but what's next. I think it's really, really important.
Thank you so much. Well
done.
Thank you to Katrina McLaughlin for joining Dermot in Dingle. On our next episode, we hear from two of Ireland's leading university presidents about the challenges facing higher education. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a South Wind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Cassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.